to celebrate the days of John Grinrod's lifetime. For those of you who are not aware, and most of you are, John died unexpectedly in the early morning hours of January 3rd. And at First Society at 5:30, there will be a memorial service. Many of you will be participating or at the service. Part of that service will be a period of reminiscences about people's experiences with John. And so between now and then, you might think of those special moments that you may have shared with him if you care to speak at that service this afternoon. This is our time of joys and concerns, so we will hopefully have found that we have some joys in our group as well. So.
I have a joy.
Yes.
Small but significant. We found a home for our cat. And he's going to be well loved. He has three children. He's already following the oldest around, so I'm very happy to see him on the map. We have photo proof images. I know Nancy about
this. Yes, Mark.
Not to add another sorrow, but I read in the paper that Heidi and Lucy's father died. Mm-hmm. Heidi has been coming to pray the past couple of years, but she doesn't know what to
do. I did stop over the house.
She's just about done with graduate school. I saw her about 10 days ago, and she was feeling very good about that and very good on it.
Yes.
I'm here now, I guess. And I'm putting the ones I mentioned on my back surgery, and they gave me a little injection for steroids and plus relaxing, and all is better now.
Hey, great.
Well, I'm
saying
keep another sorrow on this. It seems like a whole bunch of people died the first week of January. A person who used to be my boss and was a co-worker has been in three houses.
And that person?
Jerry Caldwell, was a physical therapist at Marin.
Yes.
I have a joy. My family gets to go to Hawaii next week.
Wow.
Don't turn green, my boy. We're going to be gone for about 2.5 weeks, and we all hope that we'll just breathe that sea air and all our colds will just
Okay. All right, Barbara Reyes.
Thought, why was Emerson so important? What did he have to say that would apply to us today? One of you said, I didn't know he was a Unitarian. And others might wonder why so many schools and colleges are named for Emerson. It's been my privilege to read this excellent, scholarly, absorbing biography. What a title, Emerson, The Mind on Fire. If you think you don't know him, I'll ask you to complete for me a couple of quotations. If I begin it, then you answer. The way to have a friend is...
Yeah.
By the rude bridge that arched the flood, their flag to April's breeze unfurled, here once the embattled farmers stood and fired...
The shot around the world.
Yes. One more. Hit your wagon... There are so many quotations by Emerson in Bartlett's Familiar Quotations that the index lists no page numbers, instead directing the reader to a section of pages all by him. So many of his statements can stand alone without context that he once said, I am a rocket manufacturer. That's why you've received rockets this morning. Someone said, his speeches are like an army, all officers. And someone else said, it's like a bag of buckshot held together with canvas. I don't find them particularly easy to read in present day. His language was a projectile and propellant. On the day of his birth, in 1803, his father was entertaining at dinner a group of fellow Unitarian clergymen. You married women. Even with a servant, how would you like to give a dinner party for your husband's professional associates when you were 9 months pregnant? What does this tell you about empathy, communication, the 1803 institution of marriage? Waldo's parents were formal and restrained in speaking to one another and to their children. When the boy was not quite 3 years old, his father was heard to say, "Waldo doesn't read very well yet." He didn't read at age three. They tried to be good parents to their seven children, but they were so controlled in expressing affection that at about age 10, when Ralph and his brother were late in coming home in the afternoon, their mother met them at the door saying, "My sons, I've been in an agony for you." And Waldo was sent to bed, but went there in bliss, because his mother had, in those words, told him that she cared deeply about him. Author Robert Richardson read thousands of pages of Emerson's journals, and he read the books that Emerson had read, and he shows the influence of other great writers from the past on his subject, and thus he reveals the shaping of Emerson's philosophy. I can't do justice to this book with review, but the excellent review in the New Yorker magazine, I have laminated and put on the revolving shelf back there if you want to look at it. The New Yorker review is called "Emerson, the Red Hot Transcendentalist." I'll try instead to share with you my gleanings of Emerson's thoughts as they apply to us. I think he was more like modern Unitarians than the leaders of the denomination in his time. To return to his parents for a minute, his father, William, is a minor figure in his life. He was minister of First Church in Boston, where he played an active role in public affairs. He was severe with his children. More than 40 years later, Emerson recalled hiding from him when the father was forcing him to yet another swimming lesson in the cold salt water off some port. The boy hid unsuccessfully. The father died when this son was 8 years old. The sermons that remain of the father have a bland, correct, rational tone, a calm deism. He was interested in science, had read Joseph Priestley and Tom Paine. But it was the mother who kept the family together after her husband's death. There were six sons, two daughters who did not live to adulthood. The mother took in boarders, and she found ways to get her sons educated. She was a strongly religious woman who every day after breakfast retired to her room for reading and contemplation, and she was not to be disturbed. The books she read were not formal prayers and structured devotion, but they were guides to spiritual self-help in a material world. They emphasized spiritual self-knowledge, self-cultivation, keeping the heart in the face of prosperity or adversity, danger, public distraction, outward want, injury, injustice, and death. The death of her first son at age 5 was intense and painful.
Men are what their mothers made them.
Emerson's religious strain can be traced to his mother. He said later that he thought his father had not been able to make up his mind about religion. He practiced a studied reserve on the subject of Jesus, the nature and offices of Jesus. This was Emerson's comment on his father. Ralph attended the Boston Latin School, where undoubtedly he learned Greek as well as Latin. Then he went to Harvard College at ages 14 to 18. Harvard was much smaller and very different in those days, of course. Author Richardson writes of the influence of his favorite professor, Edward Everett, with his ideas of biblical sources, the teacher influenced Emerson's strong emotional side and his lifelong interest in not what can I know, but how shall I live? One thing he learned in college was how to keep journals. Beginning in his sophomore year, he kept a college theme notebook and record of all the books he read. A third notebook was for poetry, and a fourth for lecture notes, and that became a general notebook for drafts of essays and poems. At age 17, he began a series of numbered notebooks with quotes from his reading and then comments about those quotes. His organized, purposeful, persistent journal keeping is one of the most striking aspects of his early intellectual life. During this active seed time, he was reading in all directions. He read systematically only for a particular project. He read current books and old books, fiction, history, great variety, and from almost everything he read, he culled phrases, details, facts, metaphors, anecdotes, criticisms, aphorisms, ideas. He kept this up for over 40 years. His personal notebooks and indexes eventually reached over 230 volumes. These were in part his storehouse of original writing and in part a filing system designed to store and give him access to the fruits of his reading on every topic that ever interested him. In his last year of college, he thought of himself as a poet. The Greek word for prophet is the same as the word for poet. But he confessed in his journal to feeling sick, scared, not at all eager for college to be over. He disliked the name Ralph. He had six cousins named Ralph. So he asked his family and friends to call him Waldo, and they did. The family was poor financially. The five Emerson brothers who lived to grow up were all born within a seven-year span. They went to school together, roomed together at college, talked together, shared books, wrote letters, sent money to each other, and held frequent meetings to decide whose turn it was to work and whose to go to school or to travel. Their future lives and concerns were a matter of constant mutual concern. All through college, and for quite a few years afterward, Waldo was the least interesting, the least enterprising, the least promising, and the most fortunate. He was called the silly one. After graduation, he returned to his mother's house in Boston and worked as a teacher in the school for girls that his older brother William ran in the house. He was at best a middling teacher. In the next 2 years, he read more or less continuously the writings of a philosophy called Scottish Common Sense, a broad and generous way of thinking, centered on moral issues and problems. Author Richardson says, what Emerson got was a kind of a roadmap of modern ideas, a framework within which to think, or from which to depart, a set of working ideas and assumptions, some of which he retained all his life. Scottish Common Sense claims that there is a special capacity of the soul, designated as a moral sense, anchored in the emotional, feeling, spiritual part of human nature, an ability to prefer good actions to bad, to prefer some values to others, and that this is shared by all peoples at all times. Do you believe that? A moral sense innate in everybody? In reading the works of David Hume, the arch skeptic, Emerson wanted to answer Hume. He opposed Hume's philosophy. Here, author Richardson says, the central work of Emerson's life was to be uncovering and making available those sources of power that exist in people and in the world. A few months after college graduation, he heard William Ellery Channing preach, and he was impressed. Channing, a Boston minister and the greatest of the founding fathers of American Unitarianism, was then at the height of his powers. In 1819, Channing had delivered a sermon in Baltimore called Unitarian Christianity, which was at once recognized as the defining scripture of this new movement. The denomination became a separate denomination in 1825. According to Channing, Unitarians believed in Jesus Christ as a being distinct from but inferior to God. They also believed in the parental character of God, and in this world as a place not of penance and mourning, but of education. Unitarians broke sharply with Calvinism. They were opposed to emotional excesses in religion, and they founded their faith on the belief in a moral sense that Scottish common sense said could be found in all persons. Unitarianism looked on itself as the true Reformation come at last. The strength of the Unitarian movement, and I'm still quoting Richardson, lay partly in its intellectual emphasis on the moral teachings of Jesus, partly in its modernizing of deism to shape a religion that embraced modern science, and partly in its impassioned rejection of the key elements of Calvinism. Channing had said, "The ultimate reliance of a human being must be on his own mind." As Waldo's 21st birthday approached, he felt compelled to do something. Remember, he was teaching between the ages of 19 and 21 in his brother's school. He thought he should take some step. He decided to devote his life to the church, but that was not only for religious reasons. He wanted to be first, to succeed, to thrive, to be eloquent, and to be known to be eloquent. At the same time, he blamed himself for being self-indulgent, indolent, with a weak reasoning faculty, and lacking in emotional warmth. Richardson, of course, got all this from reading the journals. He seldom felt that he'd made the best possible use of a day. Eye disease struck when he was 22, cutting off his study for a while. And later in that same year, there was extreme lameness and a very painful pleurisy. There's some doubt as to whether this was psychosomatic. In June, just turned 23, he preached his first sermon in his uncle's church in Waltham, Massachusetts. Then he went on a southern trip seeking better health, and was stimulated by a friendship with an avowed atheist who was a slave owner. He was not afraid to talk to, as Barbara Walters says, talk to anybody about anything. He still felt some indecision. He pondered whether to go into the ministry or to become an author. He was asked to come and preach, but his sermons, especially in their style, were like his father's. He knew in a general way what was wrong with his sermons. Conventional form and accepted subjects for sermons worked against any personal tone in what he said, and the relationship of shepherd to flock made him uneasy. It was an unearned moral leadership. During the second half of 1827, he preached in 8 different Massachusetts towns. Richardson put in a chapter called The Balance Beam when Emerson weighed whether he should be an author or whether he should be a minister. On one side, this would be the ministerial side, tradition, institutional approval. It was his father's church. There'd be a steady salary, stability for himself and his family, social position, respectability. On the other side, poetry and all connected with it, originality, enthusiasm, freedom to read, speculate, write as he wished. Oh my, I've left out a lot of our numbers. Excuse me. Way back. Let's hear 2.
Great men are they who see that spiritual is stronger than any material force, that thoughts rule the world.
Whoops, 3.
ideas must work through the brains and the arms of good and brave men, or they are no better than dreams.
Men grind and grind in the mill of a truism, and nothing comes out but what was put in. But the moment they desert the tradition for a spontaneous moment, then poetry, wit, hope, virtue, learning, anecdote, all flock to their aid.
Our knowledge is the mass thought and experience of innumerable minds. Power develops as cheerfulness.
Hope puts us in a working mood.
Nothing great was ever achieved without enthusiasm.
The crowning fortune of a man is to be born to some pursuit which finds him employment and happiness, whether it be to make baskets, or broadswords, or canals, or statues, or songs.
In December of 1827, Christmas Day, he met Ellen Tucker when he preached in Concord, New Hampshire. He was 24 years old and she was 16. A beautiful young girl, she loved the out-of-doors, was fond of horses. They were engaged just 1 year after they met. His letters to her are lost, but hers are warm, open, utterly endearing love letters. She already had tuberculosis, a family affliction.
All mankind love a lover.
The first well in health.
He preached frequently, supplying the pulpit of Second Church Boston, for the incumbent there was in poor health. Its congregation voted to invite him to be its minister, a vote of 74-3. He was feeling more self-confident. Ordination was set for March in 1828, and he wrote Brother William that was execution day. He wrote a sermon on the duties of a Christian minister, preaching, prayer, performing the sacraments, and pastoral care. At pastoral care, he was hopeless. And he sometimes felt terrified at the thought of writing a sermon every week for the rest of his life. The salary was very handsome, $1,200 per year, raised to $1,800 in July. So he became the financial center of the family, loaning money to Brother William and supporting Charles. He was made chaplain of the Massachusetts legislature in May, a year later, and within the same year made a member of the Boston School Committee. Emerson, the private person, was almost overnight a complete institutional person. As minister of an important Boston church, he became the public symbol of faith and learning before he had found out really who he was or what he really believed.
Alas for the unhappy man who is called to stand in the pulpit and not give the bread of life.
In June, Ellen had another episode of her old illness, but they were married in September. Her illness deepened and matured Emerson. It had brought out his capacity for sympathy. As her health worsened, the 19-year-old Ellen faced death with courage and self-possession. It was Waldo who was bowed down, and she who comforted him. She died in February 1831. He visited her grave every day, walking to the cemetery. He was committed to a series of lectures in March on the Synoptic Gospels, besides his regular sermons, so research and study were necessary.
Ask yourself.
It was Emerson's instinct and a major key to his strength that in extreme situations, he tended not to reach for traditional supports, not even for the Bible, but to reach for his own resources and to go it alone. His journals show the way his mind was going. Now this is a quote from his journal. A statement is not to be considered true because the church, the Gospels, or the Fathers say so. He now insisted that theological and moral truth must stand the same test as scientific and natural truths. He was signaling his shift from theology to science. The author says, his sermons still were tailored not to offend his parishioners, but his journals and his correspondence show that in an important sense, Emerson had already left the church. His new interest in science and his even newer belief in its powers and findings led him to say, first in his journal and then in his sermon to his congregation in May of 1832, I regard it as the irresistible effect of the Copernican astronomy to have made the theological scheme of redemption absolutely incredible.
Every man makes his own religion, his own God.
Within a week of his calling the scheme of redemption absolutely incredible, he sent his church a letter saying he changed his views about communion and wished now to change the administration of that sacrament. He'd been reading the Quaker ideas on communion. And also, he didn't like the exclusiveness of the fact that he could administer communion only to those who had signed the Book of Membership. He expected the church would balk at this request and that he would, as a result, resign from his position. But the church was not eager to lose Emerson. Neither put it in good conscience to do away with what it regarded as the central sacrament of Christianity. A committee declared that Emerson was free to believe as he might, but that communion must remain. The whole church ratified that decision. In September, Emerson formally resigned from his church. His family was disappointed. A giving up of institutional affiliation, repudiation of his father's tradition, a guaranteed social position, a generous and assured salary. But these same facts bespeak also a kind of victory, a freeing of himself from the confining forms of the church, a chance to begin again, to live entirely on his own terms. I feel myself pledged to demonstrate that all necessary truth is its own evidence, that no doctrine of God need appeal to a book, that Christianity is wrongly perceived by all such as take it for a system of doctrines. It is a rule of life, not of faith. The highest revelation is that God is in every man. On the spur of the moment, he sailed for Europe, selling his household furnishings and resettling his mother who had lived with him. And after some time in Europe, he had a delay before sailing back to America while he waited for the good weather for the sailing ship. And there he wrote what became the first of his lecture series, calling it Nature. He plunged into activity as soon as his ship reached shore. In 2 days, he committed himself to a series of lectures. The ideas of the Society of Friends appealed to him. When we think of the hundreds of people who paid money for tickets, who drove in horse-drawn vehicles to hear him, we must remember that movies, radio, and TV were unknown. Emerson had no booking agent, no typewriter, no copying machine. Many of his ideas were startling and encouraging to individual self-cultivation.
The virtue in most requests is conformity. Self-reliance is its aversion. It loves not realities and creators, but names and customs.
Whoso would be a man must be a nonconformist.
A foolish consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds, adored by little statesmen and philosophers and divines.
I put that one in next to the two in which he quoted how conformity was a demand, but whoso must be a man must be a nonconformist. He certainly was inconsistent in that place. Many of his ideas were startling, as I said. The book doesn't mention any publicity for the lectures, but word of mouth must have whetted interest in this iconoclast who had left the church. Many churches, not in Massachusetts only, called on him to fill a pulpit for one or more Sundays. And as to his income from his lectures, when Ellen Tucker's estate was finally settled, Emerson received Ellen's share of the Tucker estate that went to the Tucker children. Thus, he was assured of an annual income of $1,200. It was less than his ministerial salary, but still substantial. He helped support his mother and his brothers, Charles and Buckley, and he loaned large sums to Brother William. Emerson turned to rereading Goethe. He copied out long passages in which Goethe talks about originality and the influence of others. It was enormously helpful to Emerson to hear Goethe committing himself so clearly to the extensive and frank use of others' material.
Next to the originator of a good sentence is the first quoter of it.
I hate quotations. Tell me what you know.
When Shakespeare is charged with debts to his authors, Langer replies, yet he was more original than his originals. He breathed upon dead bodies and brought them into life.
Goethe's gifts to Emerson were two. The idea that education, development, and self-consciousness and self-expression are the purposes of life, that's idea number one. And second, the outward-facing, working method of sympathetic appropriation of other people's ideas, of the world's materials. Yet, Emerson's advice to a young college student showed that he thought there was a lot of writing one should ignore. One should skim read. Now, this is a quote from Emerson to the young man. Read for facts and not by the bookful. It's only worthwhile concentrating on what is excellent. And for that, often a chapter is enough. But remember, you only read to start your own team. We could paraphrase that, say, to start your own engine. Emerson read like a hawk sliding over a marsh, alert for what he could use. Can I repeat that? Okay. Emerson read like a hawk sliding over a marsh, alert for what he could use. He read to nourish and stimulate his own thought. In February 1834, when preaching at New Bedford, he made a side trip to preach at Plymouth, and one member of the congregation was Lydia Jackson, the girl who was to become his second wife. She was not the beauty that Ellen had been, but she was attractive, with long hair that had never been cut. She had taken dancing lessons when young and always retained a beautiful walk. Her parents had both died when she was 16, and she remembered she had felt no grief at the time. It's significant that she could remember her mother kissing her only once. She liked animals, she was interested in poetry, and had written some. When she had heard Emerson preach, one of her friends later said to her, "How did you like hearing your own ideas from the pulpit?" When Emerson was courting Lydia Jackson, writing to explain himself to her, he said, "I am a poet, of a low class without doubt, yet a poet." In January of 1835, when he was 32, he proposed and she accepted, and warm, eager letters flew back and forth. And if their relationship, now this is quoting again, and if their relationship did not have the lyrical, romantic quality of his with Ellen, it nevertheless had an impetuosity of its own, an intensity that was both intellectual and emotional. "It's a great happiness," he wrote, "when two good minds meet, both cultivated, and with such a difference in learning as to each to excite the other's curiosity, and such a similarity as to understand each other's allusions in the touch and go of conversation." He called her Lydian. That's to put off the common New England adding of R, which would have made her Lydier. She called him Mr. Emerson, always. Their daughter Ellen once said, "The tremendous manner in which she loved Father was always as astonishing to me as the coolness with which she treated him." She was terribly over-conscientious, a condition that got worse as time went on. There was an underlying anxiety. She was overwhelmed at the start by the idea of having to be worthy of the locally much admired Mr. Emerson. Also overwhelmed at the prospect of running a large establishment. And the thought of Ellen, Waldo's first wife, haunted her at times. They were married in September 1835 and moved to Concord, Massachusetts, where he was asked to deliver the address for the town's 200th anniversary. All that he'd written before that time he considered preparation and never published. The address was published and sold well. His first book then, called Nature, was really a long essay. It asserted that religion is a phenomenon showing itself more fully through nature, especially human nature, than through old texts, religious institutions, or reported miracles. There is a famous, the experience Emerson most values is the exhilaration that can arise sometimes from our presence in nature, though we can't say quite why. A famous transparent eyeball passage is an account of such an experience. Its point is exactly the opposite of narcissistic self-absorption. This is the quote. "Standing on bare ground, my head bathed by the blithe air and uplifted into infinite space, all mean egotism vanishes. I become a transparent eyeball. I see. I am nothing. I see all." If this is mysticism, it's not the common type. "The currents of the universal being circulate through me. I am a part or parcel of God." Emerson now had moved beyond Unitarianism, but not beyond religion. His sympathies were clearly no longer Unitarian, but with groups and individuals, most of whom were even farther out of the Christian mainstream. He was strongly sympathetic to Quaker ideas, and he began rethinking classical Stoicism, dividing the world into things which one can change and things which one cannot change. Stoicism channels attention to the former, what one can change. Doesn't this remind us of the modern use of that emphasis in 12-step programs? Its question is not, what can I know for certain one can change? Doesn't this remind us of the modern use of that emphasis in 12-step programs? Its question is not, what can I know for certain
every part and particle is equally related to the eternal one.
When it breaks through his intellect, it is genius. When it breathes through his will, it is virtue. When it flows through his affections, it is love.
Then if you'll turn to the back side of your bulletin, let's sing together a hymn that was submitted for inclusion in our new hymnal but was not put in. Alicia Carpenter has 12 different hymns in our hymnal. In fact, she wrote the words to what we sang this morning.
I was surprised when I read the original essay, to recognize some of Emerson's phrases in it. Elisha Carpenter had used some of those phrases with no credit given to Emerson. This is the sentence in the essay. This is Emerson's words. "I am constrained every moment to acknowledge a higher origin for events than the will I call mine. As it is with events, so it is with thoughts. When I watch that flowing river, which out of regions I know not, pours for a season its streams into me, I see that I am not a cause, but a surprised spectator of this ethereal water, that I desire and look up and put myself in an attitude of reception." Now let's stand by the way. Simplistic to say there's more here than meets the eye. It does posit a reality beyond what our senses can hear or touch. Rather than make my own definition, I will quote author Richardson. "In religion, transcendentalism teaches that the religious spirit is a necessary aspect of human nature, or of the human condition, and that the religious spirit does not reside in external forms or words, ceremonies, or institutions. In literature, transcendentalism holds that it's a built-in necessity of human nature to express itself, that self-expression, like self-development, is one of the purposes of life itself. The social imperative of transcendentalism is twofold. First, that the well-being of all individuals is the basic purpose of all social organizations. And second, that autonomous individuals cannot exist apart from others. The purpose of education is to facilitate the self-development of each individual." Poet number 20.
"The secret of education is respecting the pupil."
"A group of citizens began to meet in homes and became a forum for new ideas, a clearinghouse full of yeast and ferment, informal, open-ended, not an exclusive club." Emerson was not enthusiastic about its beginning. He preferred the society of one faithful person to a crowd of menacing, rapid, trenchant talkers. But he noted after the first meeting, the talk was earnest and hopeful. It was decided that no one should be admitted whose presence excluded any one topic.
A friend is a person with whom I may be sincere, and for him I may think of often.
The highest contact we can make with our fellow is, let there be truth between us two evermore.
There was no generally accepted name for it, but at times it was called the Transcendentalist Club. Emerson attended at least 20 of the 30 meetings over the next 4 years, and he was always a leading spirit, but the group contained a number of other remarkable and forceful individuals, with lives now deeply entwined with Emerson's: Thoreau, Bronson Alcott, William Ellery Channing, Theodore Parker attended a few times. There were women members, of whom we'll learn more. Emerson was asked to speak at Phi Beta Kappa's annual meeting, and friends urged him to publish the talk. He did so, and 500 copies of it, called The American Scholar, sold out in a month. As time passed, the talk became legendary. What was being liberated here was the single hearer. The solitary reader, the friend, unknown but always singular, who felt personally addressed. That must have been one of the secrets of his drawing power in his lectures, that individuals sitting alone felt he was speaking directly. Conversations with some of his women friends forced him to consider implications of some of his ideas. In company with a lady, it seems a bitterness and an unnecessary wound to insist, as I incline to, on the self-sufficiency of men. Too many courses of action, too many paths were, he saw, shut to women. He was asked to speak at an anti-slavery meeting in Concord. He was firmly anti-slavery and had been so for many years, but he still was not free of the casual racism of white society at that time. He was not yet ready to call himself an abolitionist, but his defense of the movement was strong, and his home was part of the Underground Railway.
If you put a chain around the neck of a slave, the other end fastens itself around your own.
The peace movement claimed the efforts of many citizens. Emerson challenged his listeners to look on peace as an even more heroic endeavor than war. The tragic expulsion of the Cherokee Indians from their homeland claimed Emerson's attention. He was the first speaker at a protest meeting held in Concord. All 28 treaties, each guaranteed in perpetuity, had been broken. Emerson wrote an open letter to President Martin Van Buren, printed in newspapers in Concord, Boston, Washington, and elsewhere. It was angry, outraged. Emerson became acquainted with Henry David Thoreau when Emerson was 34 and Thoreau, a Harvard student, 20. In April, Thoreau read Nature. In June, he read it again. He began a journal at Emerson's urging. Emerson approved of Thoreau's being spiced through with rebellion. They walked together in the beautiful Concord woods and fields, talking. They were alike in many ways.
At 25, few people know how to take a walk. The qualifications are endurance, plain clothes, old shoes, an eye for nature, good humor, vast curiosity, good speech, good silence, and nothing too much.
In the midst of his busy professional life and public involvement came an invitation to address the graduating seniors of the Harvard Divinity School.
Oh,
timely, because earlier in the same month he'd written in his journal, I ought to sit and think and write a discourse to the American clergy showing the ugliness and unprofitableness of theology and churches in the present day. It was a tiny class
class of six with their families and friends and teachers who heard him. An attack on the Unitarian establishment. He intended the speech to be incendiary. He was now long past the point of giving even lip service to even a liberal version of formal Christianity. He preached not atheism, but a personal religious consciousness. I deny personality to God because it is too little, not too much, he said. Of course, there were attacks on his address. Incoherent rhapsody, insult to religion, restless craving for notoriety and excitement. It caused more public notice than anything else he'd ever written or spoken. There were 36 comments published. His audience attendance did not drop off. There were oddballs even then. Single-issue reformers flocked to Emerson's home. Lydian looked into the parlor once with a feeling of horror at men with long beards, men with bare feet. Just as I omit much about Thoreau in this quick brush over, I omit pages of Emerson's happy times with his young children. He played with them, also nurtured their love of plants, animals, sunsets, clouds.
Is not marriage an open question when it is alleged from the beginning of the world that such as are in the institution wish to get out, and such as are out wish to get in?
Richard writes about female friends attracted to Emerson. These include Margaret Fuller, Elizabeth Hoare, and a much younger Carolyn Sturgis. They wanted a closer, more intimate relationship, not sexual. There was no hint of that in Richardson's exhaustive reading of Emerson's journals. The author says they dispensed with the traditional reserved manner associated with New Englanders, and they required more candor about and continuing discussion about emotional matters. All three wanted to get to know Emerson better, and he was attracted to these young women. Here's the sentence of quote by the author. It is not too much to say that in the early 1840s, Emerson was living emotionally, not physically, in what would now be called an open marriage. There is nothing to suggest any physical intimacies, nor were there any of these friendships clandestine. Lydia knew all about them and was herself often present, and she counted both Margaret Fuller and Carolyn Sturgis among her personal friends. In October 1840, Emerson wrote to Margaret Fuller, trying to reground his friendship with her by concentrating on things other than their personal involvement. I ought never to have suffered you to lead me into conversation or writing on our relation. While he never wrote, "I am a married man," he did limit his professions of admiration and attachment. But January 1842 was a terrible month. Worst of all, his first child, Waldo, died of scarlatina, and the sister was very ill with it also. The terrible, devastating grief of Emerson and of Lydian are a part of Richardson's great writing in the book. Emerson didn't believe in conventional afterlife, another similarity to modern Unitarians. If death is the end of life, then living is everything. Lecture tours took him to Baltimore, Washington, Philadelphia, New York, Newark, Hartford. He wrote many letters home to friends. The aftershock of little Waldo's death and the long lecture tour seemed to have renewed the bond of domestic intimacy between Emerson and Lydian. They wrote each other long, gentle, newsy letters. He still read widely. He was reading Asian scriptures, the Bhagavad Gita, for instance. These are writings that modern Unitarians draw on. He wrote that in our culture, to be imperialist, he wrote that our culture, to be imperialist, needed to see other people as different. Some see differences as predominant surfaces, trifles, coats, watches, faces, cities. But others abide by identity. These are the Orientals, the philosophers, the men of faith and divinity. There's an excellent whole chapter on his lecturing, over 1,500 lectures in his career, 35 times in Wisconsin. He was even invited to England and accepted. His Liverpool audiences averaged 750. He explored the American West, writing of his impressions and meeting such famous people as John Muir, Brigham Young, Theodore Roosevelt. Margaret Fuller was killed in an ocean vessel wreck with her husband and infant child, a terrible blow. She had been only 40. The loss made him more conscious of a side of life that he tended to rush over. He had a sense that something was fundamentally wrong with the universe, some elemental lack at the core of things. He mused about the recuperative power of his children. His own recuperative power was unusual, but the more often it was called upon, the more slowly it responded. He had a growing willingness to deal with an unhandsome, unsmiling side of life, to face that other world of experience, defeat, despair. The promise of science was that there were discoverable laws governing phenomena. He was looking for underlying order. And is not this part of many modern Unitarian beliefs? His last lecture in his 1851 series demonstrated that science and religion, far from being enemies, are at least similar and rest on similar grounds.
Men love to wonder, and that is the seed of our science.
With passage of the Fugitive Slave Law, and cruel procedures in its enforcement, Emerson became not just an abolitionist and part of the Underground Railway, but an active voice urging Massachusetts to abrogate, not enforce, that law. He attacked Daniel Webster in strong, abusive terms.
The word liberty in the mouth of Mr. Webster sounds like the word love in the mouth of a courtesan.
Over the years, Emerson gave the most emotional speeches of his career in the crusade against slavery. When he and Moncure Conway met with President Lincoln, Emerson urged the president to emancipate slaves immediately. Lincoln told Conway he had hopes that something of the desire of you and your friends shall be accomplished. Many years earlier, Emerson had written in Nature, "Above all, we must put what we know into practice, and first, last, and middle, and without end, honor every truth by its use." In these later years, he drew up a statement of ideas, of his perception of truths. Now I quote from author Richardson, and you may remember that Emerson always had a sense that he'd not filled each day well enough. The principles that he said he supported. These are not abstractions, but practical rules for everyday life. The public consequences of such convictions were a politics of social liberation, abolitionism, women's suffrage, American Indian rights, opposition to the Mexican War, and civil disobedience when the government was wrong. The personal consequences of such perceptions were an almost intolerable awareness that every morning began with infinite promise. Any book may be read, any idea thought, any action taken. Anything that has ever been possible to human beings is possible to most of us every time the clock strikes 6 in the morning. On a day no different from the one now breaking, Shakespeare sat down to begin Hamlet, and Fuller began her History of the Roman Revolution of 1848. Each of us has all the time there is. Each accepts those invitations he can discern. By the same token, each evening brings a reckoning of infinite regret for the paths refused, openings not seen, actions not taken. Emerson gave 77 lectures in 1865 and 80 in 1867. He made 2 Western trips through 14 states. Author Richardson says,
He still had a great deal of energy. He lectured and traveled and wrote and did committee work on the same demanding schedule as ever. But physical, social, editorial, and even performance energy is not the same as creative energy. By 1866, the best creative moments came at greater and greater intervals. On a July night in 1872, his house in Concord burned, and papers in his study were unburned, but the house had to be rebuilt. Thousands of dollars were raised in Boston, Cambridge, and Concord. After the fire, he virtually gave up public lecturing. In April 1882, he died of pneumonia, almost 79 years old. I have lots more rockets to pass around while we're passing the offering plate. I'll put a different basket in circulation.
And then we'll start an offering for prayer today. For those of you like myself who didn't get a rocket, take one. Time for announcements. I've got a couple myself. Today's the Prairie Fire deadline, so if you have items for the Prairie Fire, please put them in the office here in the purple folder. I had a call the other day from a Lieutenant Wes Butler, who said he's from the Madison Fire Department, wanted to inspect our building. I said, well, when? And he said, how about right now? So I raced him over here, and I started replacing all the little light bulbs. Knocking on the door, and so I went to get him, and he said, well, we passed, except that I missed one of them. So we have to make sure that all our exits are well illuminated, that they're free of obstructions. So just use common sense on that. We had one other problem with some combustibles in electrical closets, but other than that, we did pretty well. So, but it was a pretty fun race over here. I had a note from Judy Spring that I'd like to read from the Free Congregation of Sauk County, just to bring us up to date. She gave us some brochures to put in the back, and so if you're visiting here from Sauk County, you may have a more local congregation to attend. I'd appreciate if you put the enclosed brochures on display. Our little congregation is flourishing, growing steadily. There was an increase of 7 new members in 1995. 4 infants and children were recently dedicated. We're at about 45 paid members, 35 friends, and 30 children in RE. We read your newsletter regularly to gather ideas and inspiration. Thanks for sending them. And I should say that we read hers, too, because we're doing a little cross-pollinating and getting some ideas from them as well. So so that's good news to hear from them. Other announcements? Yes, Rachel.
This Saturday night at 7:30 at my house, there'll be play readers. And I invite you all to come. If you haven't tried to play readers, it's a lot of fun. We'll be reading a play, a comedy, that takes place in the northwestern woods. And it involves a mythical character called the Yeti. Play is Betty the Yeti. I think it'd be a lot of fun. So you're all invited. 7:30.
Rosemary? Due to a slight mix-up, there seems to be going to be a wedding here at the time for which we plan the Spanish speakers potluck, so we sort of lose out there since their plans are undoubtedly bigger than ours.
And the coming weekend.
And we hope their relationship will last even longer than ours, too. So instead, I've arbitrarily moved this to my house, the 4205 Odana Road, and I'm Rosemary Dorney. And I will see to it that there's a sign on the door and try to have someone here around 6:30 Monday night, the 8th, for when this is scheduled. Anyone is welcome, and we will get you to my house if you come here.
Okay. Eileen first.
For the memorial service this evening, Prairie is helping be responsible for bringing some cold cuts and think of food and setting up and cleaning up for the food after the memorial service. So,
Shirley asked for some hot dishes and bring your potluck stuff.
We had not gotten things coordinated at the beginning, so people got different messages. There's not a lot of room. There is not room to sit down over there, so very much. So we're bringing also finger food. So if you want to know, I still have a couple things I would like brought if people haven't decided what they're bringing. But you know, potluck things will be okay too. If you can stand up and eat them. And then Sharon, I know, would appreciate cleanup, and I would appreciate some help with setting up. So if there are people who want to volunteer, see one of us. Thank you.
Alina?
Oh, and everybody come and eat.
Don't be much earlier than 5, though, because I talked to David last night, and he said something else is going on there, and they promised to clear the parking lot and the building for us by 5.
Even if you don't bring something this evening, please stay and eat. We'll have lots of food.
I'm having some major work done on my piano, and it means it's going to, I'm not going to have a piano for about 3 more weeks, and I'm looking to borrow a keyboard. I have called my Briggs, but I haven't received a response, so they don't have a keyboard that I can borrow.
Okay. You mean like a portable?
Thank you. I'll see you after.
Bob?
We are looking to get together a front circle there, so if you have an interest, just ask me or reach Mitchie.
A what kind of circle?
French.
French.
Pretty associated with First Saturday. I think they have an already underway. And also, major friends, and it's a great return on your investment. I have one lucky book left. Proceeds to the Dunn's Marsh Neighborhood Center.
Yeah, I've taken on coordinating children's stories for a service, and I'm supposed to start this month. And and secondly, don't really know yet who would be good to sort of strong arm into this sort of thing. I don't know people quite well enough. So if anybody would be interested for the month of January, please approach me right after the service and I can do my duty and, you know, get your name known and let Bob know.
We didn't have children's story. It's the first Sunday of the month. They have a spirit circle downstairs.
Our music program this spring is scheduled for March 17th, and will feature the music of Felix Mendelssohn and his associates. And so if you're a musician, you should look through your music and find pieces by Mendelssohn. And if you don't have choices, see me or Delita, and we'll suggest something for you.
When in March?
March 17th, St. Patrick's Day. I'm going to look for something by his sister, Fanny, who was a frustrated composer, and we can also tolerate something by Richard Wagner, his arch-rival.
The Long Range Planning Committee will be meeting on Thursday at 7:30 at my house, which is near Tenney Park. And we've got a committee of 5 other people besides me, and anybody else who's interested in long range planning is welcome to come. And we're going to be planning a service for January 28th, which will be presented not by me, but by the whole, by the whole committee on what it means to be a religious liberal in Mass. So.
Yes, Jack.
I'm not sure whether this is an announcement from an observation. We often say that we are a unique society, and we certainly are. I would suggest to the board that they consider strongly the gathering together in one little booklet all of the Sunday presentations that have been made since we first began. It would be very interesting to read and to gain information from and guidance.
Do you mean the titles of them, or do you mean the
actual service? It would be quite a bit of work.
George has them for the first 3 years.
It's the author and editor's job. It's not something going to be done overnight.
I think our archives are pretty far of this first. Judy?
Well, this is an announcement. I just want to say that Ken and I and the girls had the fortune of going east this summer, this last summer, for our vacation. traveled extensively in the Boston area. Every corner we turned, there was another Unitarian church.
Yeah.
And we visited Sleepy Hollow Cemetery, which is where Ismael Khadrop, Otto Anderson, and David Jones are buried. So we did our tour.
Yes.
An announcement. I posted on in the almost the dead center of the back bulletin board an announcement of tickets for the Dracula musical presentation, which will begin performing the first weekend in February and has three performances the first 2 weekends in February. It really will be fantastic. And dissatisfied after seeing, I will refund you.
You think you just pay up front, Rick, and then we could reimburse you for that?
I will buy tickets and bring them to
you. Prairie asks our friends and guests, visitors, people that haven't been here recently, if they wouldn't introduce themselves, and we encourage you to do that, and then also stay for coffee. So I know that some of you got the rockets. For our friends, yes.
Mark. Parents are with us today. My name is Arnold and Chase Arnold, and I came from Davenport.
Welcome.
My name is Mary Bergen. I've lived in Madison for about 8 years, and I've been going to a variety of different churches.
Welcome, Mary.
Mm-hmm. My name is Patty Murray, and I recently moved from Minneapolis and was going to First Universalist there.
Welcome, Patty. Okay, I'll turn it back to Barbara.
If you have a rocket you want to shoot off, do so.
I've got one. This is very intriguing. There's always a certain meanness in the argument of conservatism, joined with a certain superiority in its fact.
Can anything be so elegant as to have few wants and to serve them oneself?
I like this one as a gardener. What is a weed, a plant whose virtues have not yet been discovered?
Adopt the pace of nature, her secret is patience.
Life is not so short, but there is always time for courtesy.
Beauty without grace is the hook without the bait.
There is no beautifier of complexion or form or behavior like the wish to scatter joy and not pain around us.
Wit makes its own welcome and levels all distinctions.
Do what we can. Summer will have its flowers. If we walk in the woods, we must be mosquitoes.
Do not say things. What you are stands over you the while and thunders, so I cannot hear what you say to the contrary.
Thank you for coming. Join us for coffee. There's a purse that was discovered in the ladies' room, which is going to be up here.
Closing words?
Oh, okay.
Is there a pop-up chemistry? Oh, yes,
yes. Is there?
Yes.
Speak to that, please, and we'll have closing words.
Because someone announced it, and I think it wasn't very much. Can you tell us what's next to each other? I could put in the very fire that there was pop-up chemistry.
Yeah.
I don't know what that is.
I don't know.
It's one of the celebrating art music things.
Okay.
Let's stand for our closing words on the deck. You don't have to read the title.
July, autumn, and love hush to win the respect of intelligent persons and the affection of children, to earn the approval of honest critics and endure the betrayal of false friends, to appreciate beauty, to find the best in giving of oneself without the slightest thought of return, to have accomplished the task, whether by a healthy child, a rescued soul, a garden patch, or a redeemed social condition, to have played and laughed with enthusiasm and sung with exaltation, to know that even one life has breathed easier because you have lived. This is to have succeeded.